The symposium so far today has been looking at all aspects of globalization. What we would like to do is to take particular look at the capabilities afforded by high-speed, high-bandwidth communications to enable the many functions of the university world, as we understand it, to be performed. And that includes, in the Berkeley parlance, teaching, research, and service. Maybe it also includes entrepreneurship. So that's what we're up to. We have five participants, and I'm going to introduce them in the order that they will speak rather than the order in which they sit. So there will be some complication and confusion here. But first is Rory Hume, two from me, who is the University of California Provost and Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs, a familiar title. He has also been the Vice Chancellor of the University of New South Wales in Australia, and before that he was the Executive Vice Chancellor of UCLA. The one to speak second will be Gary Matkin, who is on the far end, and he is Dean of University Extension on the Irvine campus and was previously Associate Dean of Extension for many years on the Berkeley campus. Number three will be Diane Harley, who is senior researcher in our own center, and she's right here closest to me. And number four will be Clifford Lynch, who is in the middle, and he is director of the Coalition for Networked Information. Before that, was director of what was called the Division of Library Automation for the University of California, the creator of Melville, for those of you who know about it. And he is also a past president of the American Society for Information Science. And fifth, second from the far end, we have Richard Garrett, who is program director and senior analyst with EduVentures Incorporated, a firm offering research programs, consulting services, and conferences to help educational institutions in the business world with respect to the new education landscape. So after hearing from them, we will see if we have some time left for discussion from the floor as well. So with that, let me start with Rory.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm delighted to be here, really very delighted to be part of this this panel presentation. And I promised my colleagues when we had a call among us beforehand that I would be quite brief in my introductory comments. I'm very interested to hear what they have to say, and I'm very interested in contributing to the discussion afterwards. So I've set myself the quite limiting task of being succinct, if I could possibly manage that. I speak as a great enthusiast for the use of the Internet as an adjunct and as a servant to higher education, but I will be plain about my personal belief in, at present, the adjunctive nature of the Internet, particularly for teaching and learning. So I put that out right at the beginning, but I come back to my enthusiasm because I do think that information technology can have and has had and will have a profound effect upon the nature of higher education. Administrative systems in support should be revolutionized. Access to scholarly communication and the distribution of information and the availability of information should be totally revolutionized, and in many senses it is being revolutionized. But I don't yet believe, as somebody who's been personally pushing the possibilities as hard as I can from my position in universities, that it is yet revolutionizing teaching and learning. It's revolutionizing the availability of information, but I think that there are some enduring verities behind the way that people teach and learn that at the moment, anyway, put the Internet in the adjunctive role. But I come back to my enthusiasm for doing it overall. I consider in my present role, and I have the role that Judd has, and Judd should have said it's a UC thing, teaching research, not a Berkeley thing, he's reverted already. A UC thing is teaching research and service. I have the responsibility as the Chief Academic Officer of UC to keep pushing this, and so I'm very, very interested in finding all of the ways that we can. And you won't be surprised to learn that UC is, as a system, looking in the deepest possible way with the best possible academics that we can find and the best possible administrators that we can find at how we can continue to use our investments in the internet to increasingly good effect in the service of what we do for society. As Judd mentioned, I've had some personal experiences as an academic administrator, and unfortunately, in one sense, since the internet became part of our lives, I've mostly been an administrator. I've been a dean who wasted an enormous amount of money trying to improve teaching and learning systems in my school. A tenth of our budget one year went on an experiment in teaching and learning, and it failed. We learnt things like, don't do that again. But then I became executive vice chancellor of UCLA and found that the whole campus was in relative chaos around information technology. The previous chancellor, Chuck Young, who was a wonderful chancellor in many ways, had said, you work this out, to all of the faculties and schools and research institutes. But he didn't think that he should plan for this centrally, and Al Carnesale and I decided that that was dangerous. So we invested a lot of time and money and effort in working out what we would do with the internet at UCLA, and we decided we'd actually have common systems in support of the academic enterprise, which hadn't been something that we'd thought of. We're now doing that same sequence of planning for the UC system as a whole to try and work out what we can do together to best use these technologies in the most cost-effective way possible to get the best possible outcome. One of the lovely things that Judd asked me to do when I was a young executive vice chancellor was to serve on the system-wide scholarly library and information committee, which was then looking at what was the internet going to do to the access of access for our scholars to scholarly information. And he also had me chair the search for our first system-wide librarian. And we went system-wide because of the possibilities of the digital age. And that was an enormously successful investment. We truly revolutionized, in my view, the accessibility to information for our community of scholars at very low cost relative to what we could have spent, because we did do that. And Judd and Dick Atkinson are to be congratulated for thinking of doing that for the system, and a few librarians who were helping them, but all of the librarians came up on board, and we made what I think is an extraordinary first digital, and then we realized we could share print in the same ways, access to information enabled by information technology. And we all know that in many fields of scholarship, access to information is vastly different than it was, and therefore the capacity of people to advance knowledge is greatly different than it was. We as a university system have yet to truly capitalize on the potential of information technology in administrative systems in support. I became vice chancellor which is the same as president in this country, of a university that was wasting an enormous amount of money and continued to fail throughout my entire tenure to get investments in information technology aligned with the administrative needs even of that university. And so it requires a whole lot of very careful thinking and planning. And one of the problems that we've had is that the technology has advanced much faster than our capacity to think and plan about how to use it. And so we have tended, I think, to invest unwisely in things that look very attractive, but which really weren't well grounded in good logic. So that's my brief introductory comments as the chief academic of a very fine and influential system. We are investing an enormous amount of money. We hope now more wisely and to better effect than we have in the past. And certainly the systems that we are creating are ready to serve in the interests of teaching and learning. Now, my colleagues, I hope, will react violently against me and persuade you and me that there are terrific things to be done tomorrow morning or that were done last year or 3 years ago in teaching and learning. I personally don't see them yet. So, Judd, that's my first comments.
Thank you, Rory. Let us proceed to Gary Matkin.
Thank you. 1993-94, Sloan Foundation decided it wanted to get major universities involved in online education. Frank Mayotis of the Sloan Foundation came to visit Berkeley, met with Dan Moat, who was then Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Development. Dan knew immediately that this whole idea wasn't going to fly with the Berkeley faculty. And so he introduced Frank to Mary Metz, who was then Dean of Extension. And that meeting resulted ultimately in Berkeley Extension and the Center for Media and Independent Learning generating about $2.5 million to get started into the online education business. I was a part of that, especially at the later stages of it. Then in 2000, I moved to UCI, where a group of faculty members had decided that they wanted to put a program online. And with my colleagues, we developed the UCI Distance Learning Center, which helped the faculty of the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society put up the first and, until recently, the only online degree program offered in the UC system. About the same time, 1994, Diane Harley and Martin Trow and I began conversations which immediately pulled in other people to think about how we were going to study this, what seemed to be a technological imperative that was coming down and going to hit higher education and influence it and impact it in very major ways. Those conversations and the subsequent efforts of a lot of people developed, brought us some funding to do those studies. Brought a number of funded programs from Ford and from Mellon and from Hewlett to the center, and also to us at UCI and the University Extension, where we became funded by the Hewlett Foundation and the Boeing Foundation. So since 1994, I've considered myself both a participant and an observer in the university e-learning and online course programs. And as a result of that 13 years of observation, I've come to several conclusions. The first is that internet technology is going to has had and is going to have an even greater impact on higher education. Now, that's not a particularly astounding conclusion to come to, I suppose. But if you look at it in relationship to some of the impactful events that occurred in higher education that Carl alluded to yesterday, the GI Bill and the funding for research, you see a number of parallels. The first is that in most cases when large external forces have impacted universities, the initial reaction is to overestimate what the short-run impacts are going to be and underestimate what the long-term impacts are going to be. That certainly has happened, I think, in internet, where we had a number of universities, prestigious universities, rushing into the game to get rich or whatever. And also, we had some really wild claims about what was going to happen to teaching and learning in the very short run. Those claims all proved to be, most of them proved to be very overrated, but we're also now beginning to see that these expectations on cost effectiveness and on learning effectiveness are beginning to be realized slowly. Another characteristic of these impacts on higher education has been that the there was usually a group of people that were worried about what would be lost in these new things that were coming along, and there were very few people that were really considering what could be gained. And the people that were talking about what could be gained were usually considered crackpots or crazy futurists. So we had people worried about what would happen to student life when veterans came back, married veterans came back to the campuses and so forth. We've had that same sort of reaction to internet technologies. By the way, one of the most pervasive technologies of my generation was television. You never hear anybody talking about what a wonderful effect or what a terrible effect television had on higher education, because generally it didn't have very much of an effect. Why is the internet different than television? Well, I think again in Carl's statement we saw yesterday, we saw at least the criteria that I would use, and that is, does something change behaviors? And certainly the internet is changing behaviors of both students, students, teachers, and almost everybody involved in higher education. I want to make several points. The internet is changing the way students behave in a way that almost no other technology in my generation affected. All we have to do is walk into the library at 8 o'clock at night and see what the changes, contrast what we see now with what we experienced when we were students, to see that changes are being, student behaviors are being changed. And when behaviors are being changed, I believe that the mental structures are being changed. So we have, I believe that through the internet, with regard to how quickly we can access information, how quickly we can communicate back and forth among students and instructors across time and place, in very many ways, what we do as students and teachers is different, and that is changing mental and conscious structures in our students, and changing, therefore, not only the way we learn, but the results of what that learning is all about. And it's a big subject, and brain research and so forth, but I believe it really has, it will have a very profound effect on us. And we also will see significant gains. We will lose some things out of this, as we have with everything that has impacted higher education. We've lost some things, but we've also gained greatly, and this is going to be in that same characteristic. There's a report called the New Horizon Report that was issued for 2007 already. It's a look into the future of technology in higher education. The near-term technologies they're talking about is user-created content and social networking. We already have seen some of that in our classrooms and in our campuses. The way that students put papers together, the way they can use media, rich media, to put compositions together, the way that social networking is occurring increasingly on campuses and being used in the classroom, in classroom-related, in distance learning-related courses, is remarkable, and we're seeing that already happening. So the context of learning is changing. The context of teaching is also changing. Instructors, what Carl said yesterday about the impact of federal funding, instructors are doing things differently. When internet technology is introduced, the way they spend their time is different than before. They're communicating differently with their students. They're spending more or less time communicating with their students. They're spending more or less time creating courses. Something is changing all the time as this technology is being introduced. And that, again, is an indication that this is going to have a tremendous impact on higher education. In the intermediate term, we'll see mobile devices becoming involved. Professor Gage talked about a little bit about virtual worlds. Those are going to be, in 3 to 5 years, will become important. And then in the long term, there's emerging forms of publication, which Rory alluded to a little bit, and then something called massive multiplayer educational gamings, which we're just beginning to scratch the surface of. And that's going to have, all of those are new things. They're things that universities like ours should be involved in trying to figure out and to employ to the best advantage of our students. And the challenge is not only, of course, to preserve what might be lost, the positive things that might be lost, but to capitalize on what might be gained. I'm going to conclude by turning to what I call the context for higher education and how it's changing because of the internet, and I'll particularly use international education as an example. At UCI, in a couple weeks, on April 11th, UCI Extension will receive the grades from 39 Brazilian students who have taken the first course in our certificate program in project management. It was delivered in Brazil, in Portuguese, through a partner that we have in Brazil. They will be receiving, as I say, grades from UCI. By the way, don't any of you talk to the UCI division of the Academic Senate about this. what we did is we took our online program that we developed in English project management, and we sent it down there, and a partner of ours translated it and localized it, that is, created Brazilian cases, put it into Brazilian monetary terms and so forth, and then delivered it through Portuguese instructors, Portuguese-speaking instructors that we qualified and certified. And there's a couple things we learned about that, which I think has implications for what Ahmed said last night. First is, it turns out that probably three times the number of person hours were spent in localizing and translating that program than we actually spent in developing it in English. So the notion that somehow this wonderful store of online stuff that's been developed in the Northern Hemisphere could be sort of transferred sort of easily and quickly to the Southern Hemisphere across national and cultural borders is probably at least immediately not a sound notion. And we also found that project management was a particular instance of a curriculum that could be accepted in Brazil because it had an international character to it. Project management is a body of knowledge that was developed in both the United States and Britain, but it's generally recognized as an international curriculum, so that it was accepted there as something that could be localized and wasn't sort of some sort of colonial impulse on the part of the United States, for instance. So what our experience is telling us is that it is possible to develop, I think, quickly the notion of transferability or dissemination of educational products around the world, particularly in the developing world with the possible advent of the $100 laptop, which we read about. I think Richard will tell you that very little of this is happening, that a lot of online education remains geographically defined, but that inevitably, I believe that the Internet will allow us to help the world solve its problems, which is how do we get more participation in higher education across the world where it's needed. And one other point I'll make, and that is that out of this example that I've used, I said the word certificate program. Certificate program, in our definition and extension, is a highly focused program designed to bring people from point A to point B along a learning pathway. In our definition, it's usually 5 or 6 courses long, and they're always in a very focused area. Does it make sense? Does a beverage manager in a Marriott hotel in the middle of China need to have a full degree in order to do a very good job in his or her position? To be a beverage manager in a hotel, you need to have a certain number of skills. You need to be literate. You need to be intelligent. But whether or not you absolutely need a 4-year degree when the world is probably not going to be able to provide that kind of resources across the world is something that's really should be questioned. I think we've all sort of accepted the notion that the 3 or 4 year degree is what we're talking about when we're talking about mass higher education. I don't think the world has enough money to do that at the level that we want to see it happen. We're going to have to change our notion of the context for education to serve the developing world, and certainly the notion of a uniform treatment delivered across large distances over the Internet is a strong part of that strategy. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary. We now move on to Diane Harley.
Thank you, Judd, and I'd like to thank the organizers for asking me to participate in this panel. It's a bit of a—I'm going to provide a bit of a personal view up front, because, as Gary mentioned, we've been thinking about the Internet and what I'll call ICTs, or information and communication technologies, and higher education since around 1994. It was born of a collaboration among Gary, Martin, and myself, and other people joined us. Jack McCready, I see, who's in the audience here, our CIO emeritus, Larry Rowe, any number of individuals. We've been blessed by having a series of enthusiastic and hands-on directors, starting with Sheldon Rothblatt, including the late Arnie Lyman, Mike Heyman, Carl Pieister, and, of course, Judd. In addition, and I promised Neil that I would do a plug, we've been able to work with Neil, but not on technology, on undergraduate education, in a recent commission on general education in the 21st century, which we'll be publishing within the month. And a lot of the work that we've done in that commission, and I've had the opportunity to be a member and also contribute to getting the report done, a lot of that work has influenced my thinking about technology and general education in particular. One note about what we've tried to do at the center, and that's through focused research projects, as Gary mentioned, funded in some part by Hewlett and Mellon, also by the Ford Foundation. We've tried to get participation by various varied stakeholders. That includes international, but it also includes a variety of types of stakeholders in higher education, not just policy wonks, but scholars from the disciplines, administrators, and practitioners. Our goals have been to apply good social science methods and analysis to understanding and monitoring what Rory referred to and Roger Geiger called an exceptionally fast-running experiment in complex academic environments. My comments will focus on what our ongoing work, so again, this will be personal, suggests for the future, given tensions between the old and new ways of doing things. First, there's the ease and convenience of remote participation versus losing the potential richness of face-to-face interaction. There's the necessity to scholars and students of having time for contemplation versus the demands on attention by multitasking and responding to bells, whistles, flashes, and beeps. There's the more recent notion that user-generated content, or what's often referred to in shorthand as the wisdom of crowds, will trump the role of quality, peer review, and authority in the academy. So I'd like to keep those themes throughout my subsequent comments and also perhaps for discussion. Now, we often hear about the transformational potential of ICTs on higher education. For me, in the last decade or more, what is being promised there is that costs can be reduced, quality can be increased, and wider access can be provided, usually all three at once. I think it's important to remember an adage among software developers and other in manufacturing, that if you want it cheap, good, and fast, you've got to pick any two. When it comes to ICTs and their effect on access, cost, and quality in the academy, I suggest that we have yet to figure out how to achieve all three at once and may have to pick any two for some time. I'd like to talk just briefly about why that might be so, and again, it's based on some of the research that we've done as well as research of others. Reducing costs. An argument emerged in the 90s that technology would allow the academy to serve more students better and cheaper, especially in large lecture courses where the bulk of teaching and the costs are. This cost savings could be achieved through substituting capital for labor via front-end investments in courseware and infrastructure and reducing the numbers of expensive teaching staff. Inherent in this model is the notion that once the courseware is produced and paid for, and the underlying infrastructure is put in place, it will be easy to scale up to new and larger paying audiences. Reducing the cost of instruction while maintaining quality, however, is more easily said than done. For one, there's the sharing and reuse problem. For economies of scale to be achieved, faculty have to want to, as well as be able to, easily share teaching materials. Our experience suggests that faculty in research university environments, and I would suspect in a lot of teaching environments, simply don't share and reuse course materials to any appreciable degree. Teaching in these environments is fundamentally a roll-your-own culture, and it will perhaps forever be. Martin Trow predicted and argued very clearly in a 1997 Daedalus article, which I recommend to anyone interested in the issue of technology in higher education, that the willingness to reuse others' curricular materials will very likely map to institution type, and even within separate sectors within an institution, with faculty in extension divisions, community colleges, and high schools being toward the end of the spectrum that will be more inclined to adopt canned curricula, and that research universities, at least in those cases where large enrollment courses are not offloaded to adjuncts, and liberal arts institutions, faculty will likely fall at the other end of the willingness to share spectrum. Secondly, time. One of the pleasures of the work that I do is we get to talk to a lot of faculty. We survey faculty, so we hear a lot. And this is one of my favorite quotes. Email allows me to do in 1 hour that what I never had to do before. Any cost model has to take into account the amount of time faculty and other instructors spend on integrating technology across the creation, delivery, and the revision of courses. If faculty are adding hours to their day to use technology and not receiving incentives in the form of money and tenure and promotion, the economics will not work. Thirdly, the cost of technology and support staff. Technology changes so rapidly and upgrades are required so frequently that costs may be difficult to contain. But maybe this has changed, Rory. You can. Additional factors that reduce the prospects for cost savings are the cost of technical support personnel, who often make more than faculty members, especially in our region. And then the emerging imperative for campuses to create and maintain open, free repositories of everything from courseware to scholarly publications to special collections. Now, that triad of cost, quality, and access, I do want to just mention briefly some of my thoughts on the issue of improving quality using technology. I think that there's been a myth that has arisen, perhaps primarily in the informational technology and educational technology development communities, that traditional teaching is somehow subpar when compared to technology-mediated learning, and traditional teaching is in dire need of improvement. Associated with this myth is concern that faculty are not adopting technology quickly enough. When we surveyed faculty in a variety of institutions about why they did or did not use the plethora of materials available to them out on the web, the most prominent reason was that such materials simply didn't support their preferred teaching approaches, and this was from technological enthusiasts as well as those self-described Luddites. We would argue that much of traditional teaching is in fact of exceptionally high quality, and that the available ICTs have simply not reached a state where they can appreciably improve quality over traditional methods. Adapting to students. Again, in this world of educational technology, technology in higher education, I'm sure most of you have heard it, the call to abolish the sage on the stage, to be replaced by the guide on the side. I think associated with this is the notion that technology is an agent that will free students from the tyranny of authority. The comments that we have gotten from very committed faculty and other instructors are in direct contrast to such a view, and I'd like to read just a couple of quotes. One quote, "I think there's a real danger of students becoming too computer literate and connected in ways that undermine at least compete with other crucial skills, argumentative writing, careful and critical reading of long texts, and oral argument." Another quote, "My courses do not lend themselves readily to digital resources. Any hope of conversation with the students about the material disappears. Class becomes another television show for them." Such conversations and such comments that we have from faculty and our experience, I ask the question, is what seems to be a very extreme focus recently on the proclivities of 13-year-olds, whether or not that's going to have a negative impact on planning for the future of the academy in the long run? And I ask, what voice will scholars have in the design of future teaching and learning environments? Who will be the arbiters of quality? Our work on faculty values and scholarly communication choices found that the role of peer review is the key factor cited by faculty as a means to winnow through the proliferating mass or morass, however you want to think about it, of information on the web, and peer review is essential to being able to judge quality. Scholars, either in the classroom or when doing their own research, rely on vetted and authoritative expert sources. Distributed group editing and content creation that results in an avalanche of raw and unexpurgated opinion are not likely to soon overtake some of the traditional mechanisms of quality control. And I think the recent Nature peer review experiment is an interesting case that suggests the Academy is not ready, if it ever will be. And then finally, because I think I know Richard will spend some time talking about access issues, when we talk about widening access, to what are we widening access? Is it content? Is it knowledge? Is it learning communities? Is it degrees and certificates? I think we would all be in agreement that it requires more than downloading syllabi from MIT OpenCourseWare or watching a webcast of a Berkeley course. I think ICTs have incredible potential for traditional universities to serve wider and more diverse constituencies. It will require, however, front-end investments to redesign courses and finding ways to pay for it, provision of the necessary infrastructure and tools to enable high-quality interactions, plus convenience, not just content delivery, and some mechanisms in place to assure quality and the transfer of credit. Thank you.
On to Clifford Lynch, who will widen our horizons further.
Thank you. It's actually very nice to be able to follow Diane's comments, because she focused a good deal on teaching and learning and some of the mythologies and misunderstandings, I think, in some cases, associated with what's happening in technology in that world. I'm going to focus a little more on the research side of things, although I will say a bit about teaching and learning towards the end. I hope that this perspective will, you know, be useful as another angle on the future of the university, and particularly the research university. Universities themselves have not done a particularly brilliant job of predicting and engaging this, as Gary reminded us. Probably the less we say about things like fathom.com at this point, the better. On the other hand, I think that if you look at what's actually going on in terms of the changing practice of scholarly work, of research and communicating research and conducting research, you can see a tremendous amount of adoption and exploitation of technology happening there. In a way that has been much more aggressive, I think, and widespread than in the sort of traditional teaching frameworks. The title of this session spoke to the internet, and actually I think it's important to observe that we really use the internet as an inaccurate shorthand for a whole plethora of technology developments Recently, last 3 or 4 years, particularly in the United States, you've started to hear a lot of talk of what's called cyber infrastructure. This has become an important focus at the National Science Foundation, a very strategic effort that's being led out of the director's office there. In Europe, often they speak about e-science and e-research and speak of cyber infrastructure as something to enable that. In Asia, sometimes you hear the term cyber science. But all of these really speak to research practices that have been transfigured not just by the internet, but really by a whole collection of things that I think it's helpful to spend a minute or two unpacking. Obviously, high-performance networking is part of it, but that's largely an enabler. Other important parts are high-performance computing, graphics, visualization, the ability to conduct simulations, the availability of enormous amounts of data, and the capabilities to store that, to manipulate it, to annotate it, to curate it in various ways. This is data both observational and computed in the course of simulations and other activities. We're starting to see a network that not just links up people and computers, but actually incorporates a good deal of experimental apparatus as well. Observational equipment, sensors, telescopes, electron microscopes, equipment of this type. Also, an integral part of this cyber infrastructure is collaboration environments, what actually are increasingly being referred to by the shorthand of virtual organizations, which I think is a very interesting and provocative terminology. The notion that a group of researchers, ignoring, as they often do, institutional affiliations, geographic boundaries, and other things, and bound together by a common research interest, a focus on a common piece of observational or experimental apparatus, band together to explore some problem, analyze some data, conduct some research. They want to be able to establish these collaborations rapidly in an agile kind of a way and then break them down again when they've fulfilled their purposes. Some of these are quite long-lived and revolve around very high-end scientific apparatus. Think about things like the new particle accelerator being developed at CERN, which has got a sort of a worldwide community around it. Others are much smaller scale or narrower term. I think another important point to recognize is that this set of information technologies are not just changing science and engineering. They are also starting to make their way, although unevenly and controversially, into the social sciences and the humanities. And I would invite you to have a look, for example, at the report that the American Council of Learned Societies Commission on Cyber Infrastructure in the Humanities produced last year to get some sense of the breadth of developments there. So you can see these kinds of technologies radically changing the way research is conducted and communicated in a wide variety of fields. Complementing that, you have a few other developments which are very much enabled by this mix of technologies. One is the massive migration of scholarly communication to digital form. Virtually all of the key scientific journals now are being produced in versions of record that are digital. Increasingly, they have got projects to go through and systematically digitize back files. I'm sure you've all heard about the initiatives that Google has launched to digitize some very substantial university research library holdings. While Google has probably gotten the lion's share of publicity, there actually are a whole range of other activities. The Open Content Alliance, which the University of California is involved in, is one that is digitizing public domain library materials. There's a great deal of digitizing of special collections, manuscripts, photographs, things in university museums. So the whole relationship between scholars and the evidence they work with, especially in the humanities and social sciences, is really being changed by this. It's not to say that the artifacts become completely irrelevant, but access substitutes, remote access to the digital surrogates, substitutes in many, many cases for physical access or guide scholars so that they can go and make those pilgrimages for physical access in a much more informed way. We're also seeing collections being rebuilt in a logical kind of a way. In the entire corpora of Greek literature, all of the Anglo-Saxon manuscripts that survived, these kinds of things, are starting to be reassembled from the haphazard geography they've undertaken. We've developed abilities to capture a lot more events through webcasts, through video recordings. These two are finding themselves as part of this evidence base that is increasingly important on the network. I want to simply note, without getting into it in any detail, that there are a whole set of policy discussions starting to show up about open access to scholarly literature in its various forms and gradations, open access to data, and the importance of making particularly data that is produced as a consequence of funded research publicly available among researchers in a timely fashion so that different researchers can build upon the work of their colleagues. There have been allusions already to the open courseware developments, and it's very interesting to look at these because they're being used by a range of people. They're being used by other faculty who want to adapt them or mine them for ideas, but they're also being used by self-directed learners. And yes, I absolutely agree with what Diane said. They are not a substitute for a well-taught course. On the other hand, they are a wonderful thing if you don't have access to that well-taught course. Let me close these comments, though, with just a couple of other comments. I spoke a little bit about virtual organizations already, alliances among scientists or scholars to solve specific problems that span across universities. These are really uneasy overlays in some ways to our very institutionally structured world at this point. We're also seeing teaching and learning getting mixed up in this in fascinating ways. For example, seeing leading-edge scientific data, I'm thinking of things like the virtual astronomical observatories, repackaged for high school students. You're starting to see alliances that bring together, if you'll allow me the terms, professional scientists and amateurs in observational areas ranging from biodiversity to astronomy. These are new kinds of alliances that stretch out where universities connect in new ways as well. Teaching and learning and how these technologies will affect that, other than by providing more opportunities, more materials to teach with, I think remains a very open question at this point. Certainly at the graduate level, as teaching merges inexorably into leading edge research, we're going to see students and faculty together in these collaborative environments, and that's going to change very significantly, I think. Thank you.
Richard Garrett.
Thank you very much for inviting me here today. Certain books and articles from the center have been required reading for me over the years, and it's wonderful to be here in person. In this session, I'd like to focus on one discrete aspect of the relationship between online higher education, higher education and the internet, and that is online higher education. And that's first and foremost 100% online higher education. That is online higher education at a distance, not online higher education as supplementary to the campus-based experience. I lead research on online higher education at EduVentures, which some of you may be familiar with, but many of you may not be. EduVentures might be regarded as something of an oxymoron. It's a for-profit company based in Boston that specializes in higher education research. EduVentures pioneered research into the online higher education market in the United States, and we continue to invest in trying to improve our understanding and our members' understanding of what it is now, its significance longer term. Personally, I've been tracking researching online higher education for the last 10 years or so, both in the USA and around the world. As has been said by the other speakers, in the 1990s, online higher education grew from many small experiments, projects at faculty level, departmental level, before gaining incredible momentum, largely rhetorical momentum, during the dot-com period between roughly 1997 and 2000, particularly in the USA, but also in certain other countries. Online learning was part of a flurry of interest in the internet, prompting all kinds of outlandish claims that within a few years, the cost of higher education will be slashed. Everyone from Boston to Beirut will be studying at Harvard and the like, and bricks and mortar universities will be swept aside. Hundreds of millions of dollars literally were thrown at online higher education in the US, and commentators were by turn either very enthusiastic or very worried. So looking back from 2007, what really happened to this online higher education? I want to focus on three different things. I want to give you an overview of the scale and variety of online higher education in the US in 2007, and later we can talk, if you like, about non-US varieties. Then I want to give you a sense, or rather some reflections on the nature of contemporary online higher education, insofar as it suggests both a broadening and a narrowing relative to higher education norms. And finally, I just want to pick out a couple of trends that I find interesting. One is the role of geography in online higher education, and the other is some efforts by some online focus schools, both wholly online and dual-mode schools, to take a lead in the learning outcomes accountability agenda that many of you are familiar with following Spellings and associated with the negotiating rulemaking on accreditation. So this is online higher education trying to take a lead in these areas rather than being something very much on the periphery of mainstream discussion. So let me start with the first item, the scale and variety of online higher education in the US. Online higher education has certainly become very prominent in recent years. The majority of colleges and universities now offer at least some online courses or some online degree or other programs to students who may never see their instructor and may never see their fellow classmates face to face. Online higher education has not lived up, I think inevitably, to the wild predictions that dot-com made for it. Our research suggests that around 1.5 million students at the end of 2006 were taking their whole program, largely a degree program, but other kinds of program as well, 100% online. And that represents around 8.5% of headcount at degree-granting Title IV eligible schools. And that's up from virtually zero less than 10 years ago. And if one segments adult students, so students aged 25% plus, we estimate that wholly online provision probably accounts for as much as 20% of that population. Universities and colleges of every size and shape now offer online degrees and other programs. Ivy League schools, major state universities, community colleges, private universities all play in this market. Certain for-profit companies, large and small, most notably University of Phoenix Online, which now has 180,000 unique online students, by far the largest provider in the country and in the world. And the for-profits certainly have a disproportionate share of this market. We estimate they have in the high 30% range of wholly online students at degree-granting schools relative to only about 5% market share they have in U.S. higher education as a whole, again, focusing on degree-granting schools only. But we see, because of this broadening of interest among non-profit schools, which represent the bulk of degree-pursuing students, that for-profit disproportionate market share, I think, will be eroded gradually over the forthcoming years. And equally, alongside that rather for-profit skew that the online higher education markets had in the U.S. in recent years, we're seeing, as the nonprofits move into this space, a broadening in terms of credentials, subject areas, and programs. As this chart shows, by the end of 2008, based on forecasted growth rates from various surveys that we've done, we estimate that wholly online higher education will pass the 2 million mark in terms of unique students at degree-granting schools and will represent over 11% of all higher education students in the U.S. at such schools. Another sense that this market is no way plateauing, it's no way slowing down, is some research we've done with prospective higher education students. We wanted to contrast student experience of 100% online higher education versus interest in, preference for, and so on. And as you can see, at the moment, pretty much in line with the prior figures, only 5% of these individuals said that, yes, they'd taken a wholly online program in higher education. 15% said a single course they'd taken wholly online. 17% that their preference, these were people who are interested in taking some form of post-secondary education in the next 3 years, their preference was for a wholly online program in the main or occasionally an isolated course. Then we wanted to tease out, well, online higher education is typically associated with convenience, flexibility, making access available to individuals who otherwise couldn't access more traditional forms of higher education. And certainly when we asked about the likelihood, given other circumstances, full-time work, childcare responsibilities, and so on, was it at least likely that you might take a whole program 100% online? It may not be your first preference. You may, given an ideal situation, not opt for that delivery mode, but given other pressures, is it likely that you might do so? And as you can see, a big jump from the 17% who said it was their first preference to the 41% who said, yes, it was likely, given other circumstances, that they would pursue that delivery mode. And then just to get a broader sense of overall interest in this modality, we asked, would you at least be willing to consider a wholly online course or program? And 84% said that they would. So we have a situation where certainly online higher education in terms of actual enrollment has increased substantially in recent years from virtually zero to 5 to 8%. But preference is out significantly beyond that, likelihood out beyond that, interest and awareness out beyond that. This is not to say that the average prospective student really knows much about what online higher education means or can discern varieties of online higher education or appreciate what a quality experience might look like. But it does show a fundamental openness to using the internet to deliver higher education, to access higher education, and I think builds on the pervasiveness of the internet in all other spheres of life. Now, the second question I want to just outline or make some remarks on is, what's the nature of online higher education in contemporary America? And as I said, I think it has both a narrowing aspect and a broadening aspect. Narrowing in the sense that much online higher education has advanced what you might call the commodification of higher education, essentially emphasizing speed and convenience rather than deep, broad learning, and has been developed with little reference to the classical teaching research service triumvirate. And to date has produced very little evidence on outcomes, whether that's simply in terms of retention rates or graduation rates, whether it's in terms of employability or more fundamental social improvement, if you like. Online higher education tends to focus on instruction and career relevance and puts to one side clubs and societies, supports, sports, socializing, all the aspects of the traditional campus. But arguably things that most of its constituency, if you like, the working adults that tend to favor this form of delivery are much less interested in or that simply don't have time for. Online higher education tries to position itself as something that's essentially innovative, trying to fashion a form of higher education that's appropriate for this mass and perhaps universal system of higher education that we're currently in or entering, and very much appropriate to this working adult, this lifelong learning notion of higher education. And makes a number of claims about quality in terms of robust pedagogy, the advantages of multimedia, and so on. But first and foremost, the student, I think, values online higher education precisely for its stripped-down form. I think they're much less interested in some of the pedagogic and other claims made for online higher education by faculty and institutions. And all of this essentially is a rehearsal of the age-old question about optimal relationships between higher education and society, between liberal education and more instrumental forms, between applied education and theoretical education, mass education, elite, and so on, giving the customer what the customer wants rather than giving the customer something better. Online higher education might be regarded as simply the latest attempt to fashion a form of higher education appropriate to the broader access and contemporary circumstances it finds itself in, and is essentially in the tradition, I think, of the land-grant universities, community colleges, polytechnics, and so on. And inevitably, all such innovations are both welcomed and challenged. Finally, I want to talk about online higher education and geography, and then the role some online education institutions are playing to try and take a lead in this learning outcomes and accountability agenda. In 2007, if we think about geography, contrary to the dot-com predictions, not everyone is studying at Harvard or some other remote institution, some elite institution. We haven't seen some great consolidation of higher education away from the geographically fragmented model that the US exemplifies and most other countries exemplify. Online higher education is increasingly offered in some form or other across all types of colleges and universities, and therefore has a fundamentally local character. We did a survey asking schools that recruit students to 100% online programs. So this is both schools that are 100% online in the minority, but largely dual-mode schools, and asked them to report where those students were based. So these would be students who would necessarily never physically visit the campus to take their program or their course. But as you can see, 36% of these students across 138 schools were within 50 miles of the institution. And then beyond those 50 miles, but within the home state of that school, an extra 17%. Then if you broaden the geography to the region, add another 11%. So around two-thirds, getting close to two-thirds of these 100% online students, students who would never physically visit the campus, have some geographical relationship to the institution. And I think the reasons for that are not too hard to fathom. I think essentially it's because U.S. higher education is geographically fragmented. It was created in an era where distance was important in terms of higher education access. And it's in the interest of most institutions to leverage, if you like, that local competitive advantage. Most institutions don't have a national brand. Most of them are best known locally. They've been established in that locality for many years. They've invested in local physical resources. And so it's in their interest to try and capitalize on that. And that's often a very strong barrier to entry from the likes of University of Phoenix, which try and muscle into those local markets and argue that that combination of online delivery and geographical proximity isn't important to the student experience, whereas most local schools, it's in their interest to argue quite the contrary. However, there is a genuinely national online market, a national online market, perhaps larger, it's hard to judge, but perhaps larger than we see in higher education in the normal sense of the word. 27% of these students had no real geographical connection to their online provider. Equally interesting, I think, here is the small scale of international online higher education take-up. So this would be students based outside the U.S. taking 100% online delivery from U.S. schools. A lot of U.S. schools talk up this market or say, you know, we have students from 150 countries, and it's typically 150 students, one each. That's a slight exaggeration, but that's not too far from the truth. So I think an interesting reflection going forward is the extent to which this is simply consumer comfort, if you like, with combining the convenience of online delivery with a local institution, a real institution, one that they can physically see, they may have attended previously, their friends and family may have attended previously. Whether this is an accurate prediction of the future or whether that comfort level will diminish and people will become more comfortable with the notion that they can get a full service, if you like, from a higher education institution, even if it's based outside their geography. And I think we'll see some interesting battles, if you like, between a small number of large, nationally aggressive providers like University of Phoenix and the bulk of U.S. higher education institutions, which are essentially locally based and really want to preserve those local markets. Finally, I just want to note that, in a sense, contrary to the certain stereotypes about online higher education, that is essentially instrumental. It's very much about meeting the expectation of the customer. It's very much about, you know, a stripped-down form of higher education. I've been involved with some efforts out of Excelsior College in New York State in Albany, which has become a wholly online institution pretty much in recent years. and a small number of other institutions like Capella University, Kaplan, University of Maryland, University College, and others, who see that they have, who think they have a much more positive story to tell in terms of learning outcomes, in terms of the student experience, in terms of graduation rates, and are very much trying to take a lead in the current debate about accountability notions of those, of that kind, following Spellings and associated with the negotiated rulemaking process on accreditation. These schools, because they think they have a positive story to tell, are trying to agree on a learning outcomes reporting template, arguing that because of the technology platforms that they use, they can track student learning in much more detail and report it much more easily than the average school could do, and claim, again, because this information isn't really in the public domain still, most schools don't release it, but claim that they have very strong graduation rates despite novel delivery mode and so on. So I think it'd be interesting to see whether the profile of online higher education can be changed by this kind of proactive, positive initiative addressing national agendas relevant to all schools and all schools find problematic, and whether online delivery can somehow leapfrog some of the innovation barriers that some more traditional schools find when tackling these problems. Thank you.
Your commentator will offer one thought as comments, and then we'll proceed to questions from the floor. It has been mentioned, and I should attribute this, but I've forgotten to whom I should attribute it, that teaching by internet or using information technology should be made analogous to the movie industry, in the sense that the early movies, if you remember them, were essentially stage plays taken onto film. Contrast that with what we see in movies today. Things have advanced. Similarly, I recently joined the ranks of owners of a hybrid car. Hybrid cars are but a small first step to what transportation will be within not too many years. And similarly, online instruction has started off in large measure by being lectures online with supplemental visuals and text. Surely that can become much more imaginative and will become much more different. It's a matter of thinking creatively and moving creatively, and that's what universities are supposed to be good at. So there is our challenge. With that, questions from the floor. Yes.
I'm Dale Marshall. I wondered if you would elaborate on the failed experiment of using technology in the curriculum, and then elaborate on the initiatives you're taking now that you referred to.
I think many of us could talk about failed experiments, and I can only come back to my own experience with some of the world's best educators in a particular field, in my own professional field, who believed that by making what they had available online, the world would beat a path to their door. And despite investments of several million dollars in the best possible web design, not delivering lectures, but interactive materials, the world did not beat a path to their door. And that was a failure.
Why do you think that was? Lack of, first of all,
marketing was thought to be the problem. Then money was invested in marketing. Didn't help. I think lack of a receptive audience. A consortium of universities called Universitas 21 decided to do an online MBA and invested about $10 million in partnership with Thompson. In, again, the best possible instructors, the smartest people they could find, and top-end web designers. And the first class, who were people that Thompson were paying to take it, took it, but after that it really fell away. So at the moment, we don't have the sort of, you know, Judd is right, the things will happen, but at the moment we don't have them. Somebody mentioned interactive learning games, and that may be a wonderful technology, but we've yet to capture it, I believe. I've taken, and some of you, I'm sure, have taken online courses, and you know, it's almost as bad as doing your email. It's really deadly stuff, but when legally required, we do it.
As it will be of so many.
Yeah. Traffic school, that's right, yes, traffic school inside the academy. So I think we're sort of rich in experience of good efforts to use the technology. That doesn't mean I'm not enthusiastic about the possibility. I would love us to be able to, for example, in UC at the moment, we'd love to be able to deliver the richness of the intellectual environment of the whole university to MSED. But to do that, we're probably at the moment going to have to move people much more than we can do it even adjunctively on the web. I'm desperate to find those paths because it would be terrific for us if we could. Those things said, I think almost without expecting it, the internet has revolutionized scholarly communication. And so it's with us and it'll still be with us. So I'm sure we'll keep on working on these things. It's not that we'll walk away from them. We'll keep on looking for the answers. So I'm sort of a saddened optimist about the potential of this.
If I could just add one footnote to that. I think it's also important to recognize that in these new technologies, one size isn't going to fit all. We sort of look at, can we wholesale substitute these technologies for all of the teaching we do? And in fact, there are some things that we probably don't teach very well in universities that these technologies may be better ways to do. There may be things that we're teaching through relatively traditional methods where that really is the best way to do it. So I think part of it is the techniques, and part of it is learning where to apply the techniques.
I do want to, my list here of examples as I was doing while we were talking of failed attempts and successes. UC does have one success, and that's UC College Prep, where we do online advanced placement courses for kids in schools who haven't got access to teachers who can provide on advanced placement courses. And the take rate is good and the success rate is good. So that is a local success, and it's a great service to the state, and it's been a good investment.
I'd like to also say that university, if you talk about successes, university extension, in several of our campuses, particularly UCLA, has delivered significant numbers of online courses to our continuing education audience. I think UCLA's enrollments are up to about 7,000 or 8,000 enrollments per year. UCI is about 2,000 or 3,000. Davis is about 2,000 or 3,000. So extension was, as I indicated earlier, was the first vehicle for online education at UC and continues to be a very important and growing part of our business.
Move to Martin Apple.
Martin Apple. Is it possible that what we're seeing here is an evolution of higher education to what we've always hoped for, which is lifelong education, and that this is an accelerator and a means that's getting us there, and maybe we haven't really determine where it's going to be most effective, but we're evolving essentially ways of trying to find that out. And what we're going to be measuring in the future is not education punctuated by degrees, but total portfolios of what we have accomplished in various forms of education.
I have a small part of that answer, maybe about. Until about 3 months ago, I was advocating on my campus and in the university as a whole that every undergraduate should take at least one course that was entirely online, because if our purpose is how to teach our undergraduates how to learn, and because more continuing education is going to be offered online, they ought to have that experience while they're here. And then we did a survey of our faculty members and some of our students, and I found out that our classroom-based courses were using the internet in every way that we were using it for fully distance education, and those students were already getting the experience of having an online class even if they were taking a classroom-based class. So the skills that they were developing as undergraduates were going to carry them through into their lifelong learning and their continuing education career. So I think that the technology is so pervasive and the skills necessary to do fully online programs are so now beginning to be embedded in the curriculum and in the processes of teaching and learning in our university, that that's not an issue. So I think our undergraduates will have a good chance, especially in a few years, of having all the skills they need to consume further education as it's being delivered increasingly online.
My comment is books did that really well. Books did allow us to educate throughout our lives, and it's worked really well. To me, the internet is terrific for distribution of information, and so it will be an adjunct. But I don't think it'll revolutionize, have a paradigm shift in our capacity to learn throughout life.
This is for Richard Garrett. I'm just curious, does Ezra Ventures research show any differences in the likelihood of students to take wholly online programs broken out by what demographic they are, by age or otherwise?
Sure. Certainly by age, there's a very strong association between people aged roughly 25 to 55, what we call the working adult, because of the convenience aspects of online higher education. It tends to appeal to people who are otherwise very busy, couldn't accommodate a traditional experience, have very specific career goals in mind in connection with this education. Younger and older students, prospective students, are much less interested, some interest, but and it may grow a little bit over time, but I think that combination of online convenience, career need, busy life is very powerful, and I think that's what's driven online higher education. Other than that, very weak associations by gender or by ethnicity. I'd say most other associations can really be explained by age in terms of typically higher income or higher education, higher prior educational attainment, but typically that's associated with age rather than those as independent variables. So I guess what all that implies is that we're not seeing any strong evidence that online higher education widens access in the sense that it addresses populations that are otherwise underrepresented. And I think that has something to do with access to technology. The more self-discipline required of the average learner, which therefore disadvantages less well-prepared individuals who would therefore be more disadvantaged in general. So I think it's going to be hard for online higher education to really claim that it's reaching students in that fundamental access sense rather than just reaching individuals who wouldn't have had the time or couldn't have accommodated that experience but are otherwise, right in line for a higher education experience.
Okay, let's go next to Carl, please.
Based on experience in the academy, I would say that it's virtually impossible to expect that a self-respecting academician will take carte blanche, essentially, someone else's interpretation of the discipline and adopt it, unless you're in a fourth-tier institution trying to be a third-tier institution. My experience is that people who enjoy and really are committed to teaching love to look at someone else's approach to the course, and they select the best elements of those approaches and incorporate them into their own pedagogy and then say, this is the way I do it. And I think that to expect the literal translation of someone else's work into a first-rate institution is simply doomed from the start. I'd be interested to know if anyone knows what success MIT has had in offering their whole curriculum on the internet. I expect that most engineering faculty at Berkeley have looked at MIT course presentations, but I'd be hugely surprised if anyone adopted the MIT course material.
MIT actually did a rather elaborate study of what was being done with that about a year and a half ago. And there's a ton of data on it. My recollection, just to hit a couple of the high points, is that they found very heavy international use of the material. About half of the people visiting in aggregate were independent learners, and about half were faculty someplace who were looking for ideas or a place to start or material to adapt. They have gotten a lot of feedback, apparently, from other faculty who've incorporated bits or, you know, used it as a starting point and have given things back to it. My impression is there are not very many people simply using it wholesale in a you know, teaching environment.
If I could just add to that, I do know something about the methods and have discussed it with the people who have actually done the research. Any time you say, well, 50% of people are doing X, Y, and Z, that's based on a 5-6 response rate to an online survey. So my impression is that informal learners are what MIT courseware is attracting. There are a lot of international visitors. They've created communities. They have a huge PR arm. I mean, a lot of money been thrown at this. They are developing communities in various countries to create their own open courseware projects. But my sense in my involvement with the open content, open resource movement is that there are real issues around demand. They want more demand, they want more use, and I think it is of some concern. One unintended consequence for the MIT Open Courseware was the degree to which students use it to check out courses, and that it does make teaching public within the institution. So the faculty member down the hall knows what you're doing.
There's another answer. I think, Carl, you were talking about within MIT, maybe, what are instructors doing? What the MIT sustainability model is now going to rely on to some extent is the fact that once they've created these open courseware, when you create an open courseware system, you have to create an authoring system that faculty use. Sometimes it's very formal and sometimes it's not very formal. But when that authoring system becomes something of really real use to you as a faculty member as you create a new course, then it becomes part, the open courseware becomes almost a byproduct of a function that the faculty is performing anyway. And if that function of course authoring can be made easier, particularly if it's made easier and it's also archived so that you don't have to find your notes from 3 terms ago on yellow line pads in your desk somewhere, that it's up there archived for you, it can be changed and altered. When you begin to change, again, the behavior of faculty members and how they actually prepare courses, then you've got something that's built into the bloodstream of an organization and it's helpful. And we don't have that kind of issue where you're adopting something.
I think it's appropriate that our final comment for the session be from Professor Clorda Alva, University of Phoenix.
I'm not in the business of promoting competition, but since it's my alma mater, I'm going to say something that may be useful. There's no substitute for a well-taught course. You know, nothing's going to substitute for that. The unfortunate thing is that there are very few people. I'm tempted to say, maybe they fit in this room, the people who can teach a well-taught course. It's a rare thing. And if you want to be successful in the distance education business, and I'll call it, following from EduVentures in the as a business, that you have to do faculty training, you have to create a whole system that's going to be the system that is the right system for the particular students that you are addressing. And there is distance education and there is distance education. And I think that when it is done, at least the way that we have been doing it at the University of Phoenix, one of the things that we have seen, we say that we don't have much data on this, but we've had approximately, my guess is somewhere around 600,000 students that have gone through through distance education with us. And we have all of that material archived. And one of the things that we noticed from a very early period is that our students who were taking fully remote, 100% remote distance education courses did better on the same course, addressing the very same materials, they did better than the students that were taking it face-to-face. And after a lot of research, we realized something that may seem terribly obvious. But in distance education, when done well, all of the students are in the front row. All of the students are raising their hands for every single question asked. All of the students are providing feedback to their respective classmates, to the faculty member, etc. And consequently, it has become a very attractive way for a lot of folks who, for one reason or another, could not be in an institution such as the University of California at Berkeley or Irvine, and that's most folks. It has been a very, very useful way for them to earn their degree. And overwhelmingly today, although we began with mostly the pioneers, the early adapters, since we began in 1989 with distance education, today the overwhelming majority of our students are females. They're generally females with children, with young children. And that has made it possible to bring a lot of access and certainly employability for them, and to be able to move through a career, begin a career and move through a career. So I think that dismissing distance education because it's too early may not be right on the money. I think that we have a lot of data that has already been gathered, and soon we are going to be opening up our archives from all, you know, so going back as early as we have been recording all of our courses, so that they will be available for research for the center here or any place else, to really begin to get some empirical data behind our understanding of distance education. Thank you.
Thank you.